As the alderman representing the Central West End and the Cortex Innovation District, Michael Browning knows the importance of incentives when it comes to encouraging development in St. Louis. He wants to remove politics from the process as much as possible, but he also wants to encourage the city to think differently about the kinds of incentives it offers. The alderman from the 9th Ward joins me next on the latest episode of Politically Speaking. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We've seen a county government that has had smooth and steady leadership, and I think we're on a good path right now.
I realize the office needed a prosecutor to run it.
And we have a better solution of addressing those needs.
I don't think it's about a popularity contest. What I think it about is it's time for change.
Working together across city and county, across political affiliations, that we can start to find overlapping goals.
I had some moments where I had to, you know, lean into my courage.
You'll see us work together on areas of agreement, and you'll see us have difficult conversations when we don't agree.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, Rachel Lippman. Joining me today in the studio is
Michael Browning.
He is the alderman of the 9th Ward, and this is your first time on the show. So, Alderman, introduce yourself to our listeners.
Well, thank you, Rachel. It's really nice to join you here. So I'm Michael. I am the alderman for the 9th Ward. I represent the Central West End, Forest Park Southeast, Kings Oak, and a little bit of the Vannevenor neighborhood. I am trying to take a pragmatic, reasonable approach at the board, just looking at the results that we can deliver for our citizens in the city. I don't want to just tell people what we're doing. I want to make sure that they can feel what we're doing.
Where do you think that people have been able to most feel what you have been working on?
A lot of it's really locally in the ward right now, but I'm working on some big things for the city that will affect every resident in the city. But right now I'm delivering results for our residents when it comes to safer streets, when it comes to bringing jobs to the community, when it comes to building more housing. These are all things I'm very passionate about, and we can start to see real results out on our streets right now.
So you do have a background in grant writing at WashU, and I'm wondering what dealing with the university, the federal, the state, and the philanthropic red tape taught you about legislating.
You know, I say the thing that my job at Washington University, where I was just a cog in the giant machine that is Washington University, I was by no means a decision maker there. But what it did teach me is how to work with people of all personality types. So I work directly with the doctors at WashU, specifically in the research area. So I help them process their applications for federal grants and even some smaller private grants as well. And that's a job that really requires strict deadlines. It requires working with people who are under a lot of pressure. And so you have to be really sensitive. You have to be empathetic. You have to try to understand where they're coming from and sort of speak their language. And you can get some great things done. We were able to deliver a lot of results, do a lot of great research that, you know, WashU is well known for.
Obviously, the structure of city government is different than the structure of a research university and of like the research mechanisms. But just in terms of like the need for and the structures of bureaucracy, did that make the transition into governing any easier?
Oh, I'm by no means a stranger to red tape and also the need to eliminate it where possible. There are all sorts of mechanisms that exist to protect taxpayers' money. And I think we've really seen that in the tornado response, where there's all sorts of rules locally how fast we can spend money because our charter was written in 1914. And back then, it was thought that it was really important to protect taxpayer money and be very careful on how it's spent. That's not so great in the case of a disaster. So that's been something that I think I've carried over from WashU, is that awareness that these rules are in place to protect this money. And at the same time, we need to be more limber, more flexible, and be able to deliver results for people, especially in an emergency.
And we will kind of get into how you want to or think we could tweak the system. But let's start off with that jump from the academic to the political world. What inspired you to go from one pot of arguably crazy to another pot of arguably crazy?
I never afraid of a challenge. And I think that what I was seeing back in 2023 when I ran is a need for leadership in the ward. I come to the job with a community service aspect. I try to make sure that I am serving the needs of my community, whatever that may be. And I came up through my neighborhood association where I first served as treasurer, then as vice president. I got involved with the St. Louis Young Democrats where I was their outreach director. I really just tried to be of service. Have you ever walked in a room and just asked, how can I help? That's kind of how I came about running for office. I just was looking for opportunities to help, and I saw a real lack from our Board of Aldermen pre-consolidation. And so what I wanted to bring to the board was that proactive, pragmatic approach that really started to fix some of the problems that have been plaguing St. Louis for a long time.
And so why was 2023 the year to go in after consolidation? Why not to what would have then been the 17th ward?
You know, I wasn't ready at that point. I think a lot of people take different journeys in their lives, and I think I was still getting my feet wet. And I looked at the situation and I thought, this is the time. The new larger wards are certainly a challenge, but I think we needed somebody who was up to that task. And so that's why I stepped up. And it's been, honestly, the honor of a lifetime to represent the 9th Ward. It's a fantastic ward with a lot going on. The entire Central West End, Forest Park Southeast, these are neighborhoods that are well known for their progress over the last couple decades. And I can bring a lot of good things as well as be a good steward to that community.
How do you think that past decisions or policies from when, I think, 17, you sort of core of your ward was the old 17th ward. How did sort of past decisions, policies maybe not serve the community or the entirety of the ward in the best way?
You know, I think that there was a period, especially in between the consolidation, where there were things that were falling through the cracks. Some community engagement mechanisms had been fallen by the wayside. So the community wasn't really being consulted with developments that were coming through and happening in the neighborhood. There was a real lack of focus on street safety. And so when I campaigned in 2023, I keyed into something that mattered a lot to me, but clearly it mattered a lot to the residents in that ward as well, which is walkability and traffic safety. It doesn't matter in the city if you get hit by a bullet from crime or get hit by a car, the result is the same. And I think when I started to touch on that, I was hearing from the community that there was this real concern about safety on our streets, that people loved where they lived. They liked the proximity to Forest Park and to all these restaurants. And, you know, you can walk to your doctor's office, you can walk to your dentist, you can walk to the grocery store. But if you feel scared crossing the street, that's not a great feeling, and it makes you wonder if this is the place for you in the city. So I keyed into that, and I thought, you know, if we can look at how St. Louis is structured, how is our streets department currently outfitted to do this job, and what needs to change in order to improve the result out on our streets.
That 2023 race was competitive by some standards, and then you went basically free and clear, unopposed, into a second term. What do you make of that?
You know, it's a blessing and a little bit of a curse to not have an opponent. I think I really like the engagement with voters. I love knocking doors and talking to people. I love hosting town halls and going to community meetings, because that's really how you hear from people and make sure that you're delivering what they need in the city. So I kind of missed the opportunity. I missed the forums and the things that usually happen in a competitive election this last time around. But I certainly had my share of it in 2023, where I took on two incumbents and knocked 21,000 doors with my team and really tried to just do that standard retail politics where you're everywhere, because when you're available to people, that's when they feel like they can talk to you. That's when they feel like they can bring things up to you and get their problems solved.
What are some of the problems that you're attempting to address through your legislative priorities in what is now your second term?
Well, I try to look at things big and small. Like I said, I'm really pragmatic. I'm really interested in, does this actually result in something for our city, we have to gain population in the city because we cannot keep taxing our current population more and more to pay for the same city services. The only way to really improve city services at this point would be to improve our tax base, which can be done by getting more people to move here. But the secret is that the things that make people want to live here and the things that make it nice to live here are the same things that make people want to move here. So you can deliver for people who already live here as well as attract new residents by focusing on the right things. And that's where I'm focused on transportation. How do you get across the city safely, no matter how you choose to get around? Housing. Do we have good quality housing stock that you can feel like you can move into it and maybe spend a few years there instead of constantly moving around? And how can we make sure that people feel safe no matter what they're doing? I think that it's a real challenge in this city when we look at the problems that we're having. But at the same time, I'm really optimistic because I think this city is poised for growth. If we have the right leadership, if we make the right decisions, I think we'll see population growth in this next decade.
Let's take kind of each of those areas one by one. Transportation, I know that you led the effort to consolidate all of the transportation planning that had been scattered among streets and a whole bunch of other departments into what is now the Department of Transportation. How is the progress toward restructuring things to make that a reality going?
It's going well. So we're just getting started. You know, when the tornado hit in May, I kind of joke that it's like our agenda was written on an Etch-a-Sketch and it just got shaken up. So we need to get back to it because there's been a lot of focus on tornado relief. But I think that we are now starting to hit a rhythm with that to a point where we can refocus on some of those longer-term agenda items. So for the Department of Transportation, it wasn't just about consolidating things into one department as much as it was also about making sure that we're focused on the safety out in our streets. The current streets department as it exists is only in charge of maintenance, and that has been the same since 1914, 111 years ago, back when the streets were made out of dirt and the most popular car was the Model T. So this effort is really to make sure they have the funding, the staffing, and the policies necessary to make our streets safer. And we've seen other cities do this to great success recently. And we can learn from them at the same time as do what's right for St. Louis. So that's where we're at right now. I'm looking forward to working with the mayor's office to make sure that we can start to build out this department. We have a 2029 deadline to get that done by, so we definitely need to get to work.
Is there any other legislation that you want to put in place to create the policies that they are going to be following, or do you want to, you know, leave it up to this new department to set some of those policies?
I think the most important thing is that the department contains some sort of planning element. So I see that in the form of a planning division where we have people who are focused on where are the crashes happening in our city? Where are the biggest safety risks? And how can we direct our resources to solving those areas? And much like planting a tree, you know, the best time to do it was yesterday, but the next best time is today. I'm trying to get us in a place where we are thinking ahead of time and really planning the improvements to our streets to improve safety, not just when an alderman gets elected who's interested in doing that, but as a matter of practice in our city so that it doesn't take decades to get a road like Gravois or Lindell fixed.
We did talk about this a little bit at the beginning, the structure of the 1914 charter, how it's supposed to protect the taxpayers' monies and the red tape. Where did you see the way the city's charter is set up most gum up the works as we started looking at rolling out tornado relief?
Well, the structure with the Board of ENA is certainly a challenge. They meet monthly, which is fine if you're traveling by horse into the city. But if you're in today's connected society, there needs to be a faster way to move monies. They have to approve things over $5,000, I believe. And that's just a lot these days.
Yeah.
Probably not a lot back then, but it's a lot of the things we do today. Having a strong mayor system or a city manager would be very helpful. But we have to really do that correctly. We can't just throw a city manager on top of the current charter structure and expect it to work. That would just be more bureaucracy, more red tape. And really what's needed if we're going to make this transition is, I think, a completely new charter that really learns from what other cities have done, as well as looks at the individuality of St. Louis and figures out how we can structure this so that, again, it delivers results a lot faster for our people.
On the idea of remaking the city's government structure, what can be done? Is there anything that can be done in kind of the short term that isn't a full rewrite of the charter to maybe grease the skids a little bit as those conversations are had about what a remake of government could look like so that people don't feel like a charter rewrite is just being thrown upon their communities?
Well, I think we need to look at and do a little bit of a postmortem on the Charter Commission. That was an ambitious effort that didn't really see the follow through that it needed. One big missing component was community engagement. You always hear this, not about us, without us. And I may have butchered that slightly, but
the sentiment is there,
but
for
the
sure.
The sentiment is there. And, you know, the idea is that we need to be walking people with us as we make these changes. So holding a public engagement event in North City as the very last stop of this long process and just saying, surprise, we're looking at eliminating the comptroller, that's not going to go over well. And it didn't. But at the same time, we need to be courageous and imagining how we might improve these things. We need to not be afraid of how changing something might change the way our city works, because I think we can all agree the status quo isn't working. I just think that if we're going to do the charter effort again, and per the edit to the charter that we made, the Charter Commission is supposed to meet every 10 years. Now is a great time to look at the failures of that Charter Commission and figure out what we can do to support it better. And I think starting with a budget for community engagement would be an excellent place, because if we can do that, we can make sure that whatever changes we propose to the public will be well supported and actually get passed. What you saw out of this last Charter Commission is several ideas came out of it, but only a few made it across the finish line, like the Department of Transportation. And that was partially due to just the popularity of those ideas, but it was also due to the hard work of people like myself to go out and pitch those ideas in public. I can't count how many neighborhood meetings I went to in a short amount of time to tell people about why this was a good idea. But it shouldn't always be like that. We should be including people through the long process so that they feel bought in.
Another one of the areas that you mentioned was housing. Tell me a little bit about some of the policies you want to be working on in this term for around building housing that can attract people back to the city and also allow people who maybe lost their homes in the tornado to stay here.
Well, there's no doubt that we need more housing now, especially after the tornado. But even before that, we were demolishing housing faster than we were building it in the city. And if we're going to grow population, we definitely need those options available. It's about having a diversity of housing so that no matter what you're looking for, you can find it. So the recent bill that we passed to make it easier to build accessory dwelling units was a nice step. Is that going to solve the problem? No, it's going to be a small kind of drop in the bucket. But at the same time, doing more policies like that, as well as looking at how we incentivize the building of more housing. There's a problem that St. Louis has where it is expensive to build here. It's gotten even more expensive since the pandemic. Construction costs are way up. Interest rates have not really eased much. We need to make sure that projects are penciling, as they say, that they actually can make money by building housing, because the city doesn't build housing, the state doesn't build housing, the federal government doesn't build housing. We rely on private developers to build this housing. So we need to find a way, whether we like it or not, we live under capitalism, and we've got to figure out a way to build housing underneath that system. So one example of how we can do this is something I'm doing right now with the Engineers Club on Wendell. That is a
That's
site.
That's like right by.
It's right next to Rosati Kane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, yep, right by the cathedral in that area, yeah.
And it's an old mid-century building that has some design flaws. We're looking at a situation where several developers have kicked the tires on a project here, but without being able to remove the building and only being able to build around it, they've found themselves stuck, and they just can't.
And is that
make it
is that
work.
Because it's a histor- is it a historic component there that they're running into, or
there's a historic component, okay. And then there's just the layout of the building. It kind of sits in the middle of its lot, so you can't build around it and make the project pencil. So what we're doing is we're putting together a development plan that I'll be introducing soon, which will offer some mild incentives to get a project started there. Why are we doing that? Well, right now it's a nonprofit, which means the city is getting $0 from it when it comes to taxes. We want to get to a point where this is a productive piece of land for our city, where it is not only on our tax books, but also providing a need. And the need for housing in that spot is really strong. So we'd like to get them to a point where they can sell their building and they can get some sort of housing built there. So we're going to pass a package without a developer in mind that offers a mild incentive to get started there. And if that is successful, I think we should be looking at that model more, because what's been happening recently is politics have been getting in the way of some of these projects happening. We recently lost a $120 million project on Kings Highway. $120 million, 300 plus units, and unfortunately, we couldn't get the numbers to work, which is unfortunate because I think that was more political than practical. We ended up having moving goalposts at the city that made it really difficult for that project to work. And that's where I think we need to get politics out of the process and move it more towards a system like we're doing with the Engineers Club, where we're offering this ahead of time, letting people know up front, here's what you're going to be eligible for, and then trying to entice them in a way that makes it clear that we'll be a good partner in this process.
So you would go to a strategy where aldermen do the work. They say, we believe that this is the level of incentives that are needed to have this project. Here is what we can offer you, developer unknown. Give it up front rather than the developer asking. Okay.
Yeah.
And what's the benefit of that? Like, is it just sort of the stability that, you know, this is inked, nothing is going to move?
That's right.
Take it or leave it kind of thing?
Predictability is the word, right? So it's a huge risk that developers are taking when they try to build housing or anything else in the city. We don't get very high rents compared to cities like Chicago or New York. And so projects need to really fill that gap if they're going to build, the gap between what it costs to build versus what they can charge for it. So the city saying this is what we can offer ahead of time, and that knowing that that goalpost won't move, it's really, really important to attracting private investment into the city. What's really important, of course, is to really closely analyze the benefits to the city and our schools, because we have to be careful about that when we're abating taxes, especially for property. But if we really scrutinize this and make sure that it's a deal that makes sense, like I said with the Engineers Club, we're getting $0 from that building right now, which means the schools are also getting $0. If we even mildly incentivize something, that's a win-win for the schools and the city. I also just don't think incentives are the dirty word that everyone tends to think they are. Again, it's about making sure that these projects actually pencil. People need to find a way to build housing, deliver jobs, everything that really makes this city better for the people who live here. Because we talk about affordable housing all the time, and that is important. We should be building affordable housing. But what we forget to talk about is wages and making sure that people have a high enough salary to be able to afford other housing in our city. We cannot build an entire city out of affordable housing. Like I said before, we need a diversity of housing types in order to build a sustainable city that can deliver excellent city services. We kind of have a tool belt that the state has given us, and using those tools to bring those things that the city wants, that is how we benefit the whole city. There's an old adage, which is simply that if you want less of something, tax it. If you want more of something, incentivize it. And that's really the philosophy with which I'm working.
What are some other tools that you're either thinking about or learning about that you would want to see the city use?
Well, like I said, I think I really want to make sure that we are not politicizing the incentive process. We ought to be taking politics out of it as much as possible. The fact that it goes to the Board of Aldermen to pass these incentives introduces that uncertainty and that political edge. If you think about it, my colleagues and I aren't experts on a lot of these things. I can tell you the price of steel these days, although I'm sure it's more than it was a few years ago. I couldn't tell you the costs that go into these kinds of projects. So we need to legislate less on vibes and more on facts. And that's where we need to trust the experts that look at these numbers. You know, we have the St. Louis Development Corporation. We have our planning department. So I think whether it's the new zoning code that's in process, which is going to be a huge help to that predictability standards of saying, hey, this is what we want in this spot. But then we need to also work on the financial side of that. And that's where I think if we could remove our political bodies as much as possible, because when you send something to a political body, it gets political. And I think a lot of the time this is math. And if the math doesn't work, then it's not going to work for our city.
You seem to have politics kind of creep into the Cortex development. It took you a couple of tries to get the Blight redesignation there to allow that to continue. What was your take on what happened there? I have my take. I want to hear what you sort of think. Was that the politics kind of popping in there, going on vibes? Or
there was a little politics in there, but, you know, there's also just some misunderstandings. A colleague dropped off the meeting. They were on Zoom, and they had dropped off, and I didn't realize it. So by the time the vote was called, that vote was missing. And there were a couple other people who were out for other reasons. The next week, we were able to bring it back, and all three of those people were back. And you'll notice that the vote didn't change other than the three people who returned and all voted for it. So it was just kind of a mistiming thing more than politics. But certainly that was a tough bill to get passed. There's some skepticism there about these kinds of tools. And I think better education is necessary so that people understand the benefits that these are bringing to the city. Cortex is a real success story for the city.
Give the elevator education to a skeptic or someone who may sit there and go, why does an area like Cortex still need incentives to develop?
Yeah, simply, it isn't done yet. So this is part of a redevelopment agreement that the city entered into with five entities back in the 2000s. And what it has been doing is it's been turning an old industrial area right in the center of our city, right between the SLU campus and the Washington University BJC campus. It's been turning this old industrial area into a new kind of job area. So we're seeing lab spaces, we're seeing companies like Microsoft, companies that bring these really cutting-edge jobs to St. Louis and create opportunities for innovation. A lot of companies that come out of Washington University need a place to land in St. Louis. Otherwise, they'll end up going to another city. And a great example of this is C2N Diagnostics. So last session, we had a bill that, similar to what we're doing with the Carriage Works building, where we were using an incentive to help them build out that space, we did with the old Goodwill building on Forest Park Avenue, where C2N Diagnostics, a company that is on the cutting edge of treating Alzheimer's disease with an incredibly innovative test that helps measure the efficacy of drugs that treat that disease. This company had an option to stay here where they were founded or move to Denver where their other partner was from. And the city was in a place where it could have lost this great company that created a lot of great jobs and also is going to possibly put St. Louis on the map when it comes to treating a really terrible disease that has affected so many families. So this is an absolute win for the city to keep this homegrown company here in the city. And they couldn't have done that if Cortex didn't exist and if we weren't building out these former industrial spaces into these new innovative places where people can bring that sort of progress that the city needs.
I know the Armory is not in your ward, but mm-hmm. you are quoted as saying about the proposed data center there, you're going to create a void in Midtown. Leaving out any kind of objection to data centers as an entity, when you look at the Armory, is there really any way to activate that portion of Midtown? You've got the highway, the rail yard, and the power plant sort of hemming that in. Isn't it kind of already a void? Wasn't that part of the problem with putting what they had envisioned for the Armory there?
Oh, there's absolutely an opportunity here. And you need to look no farther than the Foundry. As a development, the Foundry used to be the old Federal Mogul site, and it was the biggest polluter in St. Louis. Now it is a place where there are restaurants, shops, a movie theater, a grocery store. It is a fantastic, successful development from what used to look like a lost cause. Similarly, just to the south of it, where the Armory sits, it seems like it's been the victim of a lot of bad decisions. The double-decker highway, the railroad tracks that are nearby, the power station, all these things you mentioned. But there are efforts underway right now to connect it better. The Spring Viaduct connector that will go across the highway and connect the Foundry with not only the Armory, but also the Grand Metrolink station, which is the second busiest station on the line.
I'm assuming the first is somewhere like downtown?
It's the Central West End.
Oh, okay. That makes sense,
a lot
actually.
Of people take it to the hospital. And so what we're seeing is efforts that are going to connect it. The Brookline Greenway is supposed to go right through that area. So really avoiding doubling down on bad decisions of the past and looking to the future to undo these decisions or improve them in a way that we can create interactive and really lively spaces in our city. I envision connecting the Foundry all the way down to the new SSM hospital that's currently under construction. If you go stand at the Armory, you can actually look to the north and see activity. You can look to the south and see activity. And really, there's activity in every direction. You've got the Grove to the west. You've got the rest of Midtown to the east. And it's just an opportunity for something much better than something that employs very few people and has very little foot traffic. So I really do think that when we look at planning our city, it's important to look at how we connect places better, as well as not just say, well, that's a lost cause. Let's just continue to use it in a terrible way. But to say, hey, that may have been something bad in the past, but it can be something better in the future.
There are two other pieces of legislation that you have relating to elections. One would lower, actually, the fee to run for office for, I think, all of the citywide positions. Am I correct? Or at least the city-city positions, not the city-county positions. Am I correct
about
that?
The city-city positions and the aldermen as well.
What's the motivation behind that?
Well, simply that it should be affordable to file for office. The county city positions all have a $100 flat filing fee.
And that's like circuit attorney, treasurer, the positions we have because we are our own county.
Right.
Which is a whole other...
It's a whole other thing. But those are only $100. But something funny happened when the Board of Aldermen consolidated. We also doubled the salary of alder. They were making not a great wage before that really required them to have a second job, which created conflicts of interest. This new board gets paid a salary of $73,000 a year, which is a lot more appropriate for this day and age. But the filing fee language for aldermen was tied to the salary. It's actually equal to 1% of the salary. So when they doubled the salary, it also doubled the filing fee. And that meant that we now pay to file for alder, the lowest level of elected position in the city, we pay more than it costs to file for U.S. Senate. So we're thinking it's better for democracy if more people are running for office, because especially with approval voting, the way that we vote in the city, it's built on the idea that you can choose from multiple options. If you have two or fewer people, that's not really utilizing that voting system to its best ability. But when you lower the filing fee, we're hoping that we'll see not only more people be able to file for office, but also have a more equitable approach to this, where you don't have to pay a month's rent to just file and be on the ballot.
And you do have one other piece of legislation that irons out some of the quirks that have arisen with the way approval voting was implemented. Tell me a little bit more about some of those changes and if and how those two pieces kind of work together.
So it's actually all the same bill. So this really the first attempt that we made was to lower the filing fee. That didn't end up being very popular. So we've kept at it because I really do believe in this affordability. I really believe that it shouldn't cost an arm and a leg to file for office. But the rest of the code was quite complicated and messy on its own. When we passed Prop D, which created approval voting, it added language to the election code, but it didn't take away any of the old language. It just kind of had a line which was like, ignore all that other stuff. So this new bill revises the entirety of that code, really fixing things like what happens if you have two or few people running for a seat. We are putting it so that
you are a case in point of that.
We still have a primary because the election's happening anyway, so we want to make sure that people see the names they're looking for on the ballot, and that's not confusing. It also answers questions like, what happens in a tie? In all of the city's history, there's never actually been an exact tie. But it's important to have in the code, and just in case there is, because under the current code, it would defer to what state statute says, which would send it to the Board of Aldermen to decide, which feels a little bit like a survivor situation where we're maybe voting our colleague off the island. So not the best
method.
You know,
that could be amusing in some ways, but...
maybe amusing for the rest of you, but I don't know if I want to be doing that.
That is fair.
But this now puts in place a system that if there's a tie, it goes to actually whoever collected more signatures on the original petition to be on the ballot, thus creating an incentive for people to collect as many signatures as possible and talk to as many voters as possible, but also to create a clear guideline of, all right, you've tied, who's going to actually come out on top?
Politically Speaking is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. Ninth Ward Alderman Michael Browning, thanks for being on today.
Thank you.
Until next time, so long.